Chris Hester, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Today, my topic concerns a set of submissions for requests for correction, technically known, to the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which has been filed by two members of scholars and another investigative journalist. And the lawyer who is a 9/11 activist lawyer is my special guest today. His name is Jerry Liepart. Jerry, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the Dynamic Duo.
Good afternoon, Jim. It's good to be on with you.
Absolutely terrific. So I'm looking at the website, 911scholars.org, and at the top of the featured articles, there's one entitled Scholars File Challenges to 9/11 NIST Reports. Submissions may shatter the cover-up, founder declares. Apparently, somebody thinks this is a pretty important deal, and of course, that would be me. Jerry, I think you got something going here. I'd really like to take time, you know, in a leisurely fashion to discuss all this
and
explain how you came up with this idea, because it seems to me to be completely brilliant.
Well, thanks, Jim. The effort to find a way to use the facilities, resources, and techniques that are available to the 9/11 truth movement as a whole have been discussed among us, between us and among us, both in a cooperative way and sometimes in a contentious way. But through all of that, I actually think it's fair to say, Jim, that the idea of utilizing the Data Quality Act in order to fashion a challenge to the official report published by the National Institute of Standards and Technology in September of 2005 is really a collaborative effort. And let me tell you, how it developed, as nearly as I see it in any event. And that is to say that, first of all, Jim Hoffman on, 9/11 Research, website did an excellent, analysis of the, of NIST's, report, even when it was in draft form. Now, that report is officially designated by the letters NCSTAR-1. So we call it NCSTAR-1. And as early as the next-to-last draft of NCSTAR-1, Jim Hoffman had done an excellent analysis of the weaknesses or many of the weaknesses of that report. I can tell you that a number of people mentioned or have made mention of the possibility of utilizing the Data Quality Act to fashion challenges. And I know that you and I among others had discussed the possibility of doing so from perhaps the last quarter of 2006 up to the present. I'm saying all of this really as a way of making sure that no one thinks that that we're doing this because we are like the innovators or that we're ahead of everyone else. I think it's important that that I be on record as saying that there are a lot of people who more or less at about the same time gave thought to this process. Now, it is true, Jim, that that the individuals that I am working with, namely Edward F. Haas, Dr. Morgan Reynolds, and Dr. Judy Wood, are three individuals who have, in fact, gone forward taking the step of actually filing requests for correction with NIST, which, of course, is an agency of the U.S. Department of Commerce. And the Commerce Department, through its Office of Chief Information Officer, has, in fact, posted all of these requests for correction up on its website, and anyone, any member of the public can access them in their in total. That is to say, the complete text of each of the requests for correction.
Just for those who may be listening, if they go to 911scholars.org and if they scroll down to featured items, they'll find this report, this press release, actually, from the Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And inside, in the third paragraph, you'll find a link that will take you right to the NIST, the official government site, where you can find all three of these requests, plus actually a fourth submission from this group by Judy Wood, which has an additional content of a memorandum from you, Jerry Liebhardt. And in addition, it turns out there's one further request for reconsideration that has something to do with heat and structure and buildings from a building association. Is that not right, Jerry?
Well, that's correct. However, Jim, that particular additional request for correction does not pertain to the NC Star 1 report. That involves another subject matter that comes under NIST's jurisdiction, but that's not a challenge to NC Star 1. So that, in fact, the three RFCs plus, as you mentioned, the one containing an additional supplement for an actual clickable total of four, those are all done by the individuals that I'm working with.
That's terrific. So tell us about them.
Well, basically, the first one filed was that of Ed Haas, and Ed has over the last year or so, through his investigative journalistic website called the Muckraker Report, done some fairly extensive work on the nature of NIST's investigation of both the destruction of World Trade Center Twin Towers, Buildings 1 and 2, as well as the ongoing investigation of the destruction of World Trade Center Building 7. As many of your listeners will know, NIST has not yet even issued a report on the destruction of Building 7. Well, Ed Haas early on recognized that there was a clear or certainly an apparent and probably a clear conflict of interest in based on the fact that some of the same contractors who had worked with NIST on developing NC Star 1 had been contracted by NIST to do the report on Building 7. And I hear that lead-out music, we'll be right back.
Stand by, we'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Jerry Liebhardt. We'll be right back. Today, my special guest is Jerry Liebhardt, a 9/11 activist attorney who's been the legal representative for three students of 9/11 who have filed requests for clarification with NIST, which I believe has the potential to shatter the cover-up. Jay, we were just talking about the first submission by Ed Haas. I should make a point of clarification for our listeners. If they go to the featured articles and look at the press release, if they click on the link provided, you have to make sure the comma isn't included. If the comma is included there, then it'll lead you to just a page that says not to be found. But if you take off the comma, you'll get right to the relevant page. And just as you observed, Jerry, there are now two submissions for energy loss by buildings that have nothing to do with 9/11. Then the three reports plus the supplement for 9/11. And then there are a couple. There's another Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary draft management plan that has nothing to do with it either. So you're right on all scores.
Okay, Jim. So I was saying that Ed Haas's RFC pertains primarily to Building 7. And to be brief about it, the interim reports that have been issued by NIST on Building 7 seem to want to go to extraordinary lengths to make the declaration that they, NIST, have found no evidence of controlled demolition thus far in their investigation. Well, Ed's request for correction points out that statement is contradicted by the actual content of NC Star 1, where in NC Star 1, the language used concerning controlled demolition was, if anything, vague, disingenuous, and perhaps worse than that, perhaps going so far as to be at least misleading, if not fraudulent. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in the NC Star 1 report, the declaration was that they could find no corroborating evidence of controlled demolition. So note that phrase. Corroboration means evidence over and above that which has been found. Moreover, the language used in NC Star 1 is even more disingenuous than that, because it actually says they could find no corroborating evidence of controlled demolition resulting from explosives planted prior to September 11. Well, good grief. Yeah, you don't have to be a linguist to understand that you are there being presented with extremely carefully crafted language that, if anything, constitutes an admission that they did indeed find a considerable amount of such evidence.
This seems to be an area of specialization for NIST, Jerry, that they're artful in crafting statements such as about the amount of time it took for the buildings to be destroyed.
Exactly. So just in that specific sense, that provides you, I think, with sort of the essence of what a request for correction is. If the language is erroneous or misleading, then it has to be corrected. So having made one declaration about evidence that they said they found in one document, at the very least, that same language has to be carried over into their subsequent documents, which it was not. Now,
on pain of inconsistency, of course, so that one document would contradict the other.
Yeah, you can't do it. So that's what the Data Quality Act, under which these requests for correction are filed, requires. That, you know, data has to have integrity. That's what quality means. That, you know, that it cannot, you cannot have documentation that goes out to the public that contains inherent, you know, contradictions, such that people cannot know what has actually been found or what is actually being determined, much less, you know, how they are to go forward. So in actual fact, it would appear that, you know, as odd as it may seem, that the Data Quality Act does in fact provide not only a plausible way to challenge some of the existing findings concerning the events of September 11, 2001, but it actually is a close fit.
Do you know that the Data Quality Act has been widely used in the past? I mean, it's interesting to me that we do have these other submissions recorded now on the government's website that, you know, suggest to me the possibility that it may have been used fairly often for different purposes than this.
Well, it has been used for other and different purposes. I actually, you know, I'll spend a little bit of time on that, Jim, because I think it, you know, the listeners, you know, might like to know a little bit about it. But then we've got the other two to touch base on as well. And briefly, the Data Quality Act is fairly new. It became effective in only in the year 2000, And it was the act itself contains only two and a half paragraphs of text, and it actually came into law sort of as a rider on a budget or appropriations bill passed in 2000. It's almost an afterthought kind of piece of legislation, not debated very much, not considered. And you can actually look upon it as being the result of sort of the collapse of the legislative process that has, taken place over the last several years. But the backers of the Data Quality Act, oddly enough, are our industry. Corporate America was behind the effort to insert the Data Quality Act into that legislation and have it become law, because it was intended. We'll hold that thought.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Jerry Liepart. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. Today, my special guest is Jerry Liepart, a 9/11 activist attorney who's representing the complainants in three different complaints that have been filed with the NIST under the Data Quality Act, which in my opinion has the potential to shatter the cover-up in this case. It's extremely important stuff. Jerry, you were just talking about the second of the three complaints.
Yes. Let me just finish up by saying that industry, that is to say corporate America, you try to utilize the Data Quality Act to thwart or to slow down the effectiveness of various regulations that they may not like. Okay. So now, be that as it may, the fact is...
So that's the history of it, Jerry. You're saying corporations, businesses have used it to try to slow down government and implementing regulations that would govern them by insisting there's something wrong or faulty with the evidential basis for the regulations.
Right. And basically what that means is that, sometimes regulations are contradictory. So we go back to that question of contradiction or inconsistency. So what we're doing with respect to NIST and its, and the pronouncements in its official documents is basically, structurally, pretty similar to what industry tries to do. If the government, puts out information that, is contradictory, that industry, cannot follow, as a result of the inclusion of directions that seem to say go left and go right at the same time. They can't possibly do both. And so so it is with the declaration that NIST came up with concerning controlled demolition. They say they found evidence of it in some of their documents. But then in others, they, they're disavowing that in connection with their ongoing investigation of WTC-7. Mr. Haas is making note of that in his request for correction, and that's where that is. Now, needless to say, there are other legal implications here, it's not within my province to say what might happen here. However, the basis for Ed Haas's request for correction is, in my opinion, legally valid. Now, I think I'm putting it that way because obviously we're up against the powers that be. And the legal system, the administrative regulation system for making or involving the making of administrative agency rulings, are all subject to the powers that be, consisting in the side that is represented by the most wealth and the side represented by the most firmly entrenched of the vested interests usually prevail in these things. Now let's face it, the 9/11 truth movement does not represent the establishment here, so we have no advantages other than the strength of our ideas. And that is what we are putting to the test, the strength of our ideas.
The truth of our evidence and the soundness of our reasoning.
That's what we can bring to the table. When we are at our best, I encourage all in the truth movement to have that as the overriding objective. That's our strength.
I just have to compliment you, Jerry, because I think this is such an ingenious approach and completely appropriate. I mean, you know, I agree with you, of course, in acknowledging all of the good work that has gone on by others in the past, and this is true before the formation of Scholars in December of 2005. A lot of people were doing a lot of good work, so
yes,
that in many respects we are standing on their shoulders in order to accomplish what we're accomplishing. But I just have to compliment you for taking the initiative on this and for seeing it through.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jim. Well, listen, let me tell you how I think your listeners you know, might benefit by getting something new from our discussion today, Jim. And that is that you know, the challenge to, or the log jam that is building up, that you know, the sense that we have is that the truth movement is right on the verge of breaking out into the open in and impacting upon the public's awareness and the public's consciousness. And the thought is that efforts like those that Ed and Morgan and Judy are involved with will be a part of that process. The thinking is also that at some point, you know, people on the inside who know what happened, who know what went on, or who have information about it, have got to come forward too. These are your so-called whistleblowers, Jim. And in giving thought to, you know, what prevents, you know, people with information from coming forward, it behooves us to know a little bit about the pressures that such people, you know, are under. And there, what you have are the rules and the regulations that govern security clearances and that govern people and the conduct of people who have access to classified information. Jim, you know, if you think the Patriot Act is hard upon ordinary citizens, I got to tell you that the regulations that govern people who have access to classified information are pretty draconian. You know, those people really do pay an extraordinary price for access to information. They can be subjected to polygraph tests. You know, their clearances can be you know, taken away from them. You know, on the basis of a wide variety of activities. I mean, you know, if some of those people happen to come into contact with, say, a foreign citizen or a national of a foreign country, you know, whether they know it or not, you know, that's something that can put them under a cloud of suspicion, Jim. So, if time permitting, we may want to talk a little bit about the apparatus of having access to certain types of information within you know, within the current climate.
Yeah.
Now we that's important as well, because in thinking about the question, well, how could something like 9/11 happen, where, you know, all of the information available to us and the information that is both implicit and explicit in the other two requests for correction that we'll discuss certainly implicates, you know, people who have access to classified information. And we say it not because simply because of the information, but because the, you know, those are the people who can do the things that needed to be done for 9/11 to happen.
We'll come back to these questions. My special guest today is Jerry Liepart. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is a 9/11 activist attorney, Jerry Liepart, and we're discussing three submissions, really technically requests for clarification or correction, requests for correction under the Data Quality Act that are related to the reports of the National Institute for Standards and Technology. Jerry, please do continue.
Okay, Jim. I think I was just finishing up little bit of a discussion on the restraints placed upon people having access to classified information. And as you look more closely at that process, there are various kinds of information, including some that is called compartmented information. And so this means that people have access to a part of something that might be taking place, but only a part of it. Now, one can envision that for something like 9/11 to take place, it may very well have been made possible by the use of compartmentalized information,
yeah,
where a large number of people knew that they had a certain task to do, but then only knew, that much of it. And now, in the aftermath of it, they may not even be exactly sure what they did. Plus, in any event, they cannot talk about it.
Yes, yes, yes. Many of them may well have felt too that they had a responsible role. What they were doing was, for example, in the case of the air defense, drill. So this was perfectly proper and appropriate, and they were just fulfilling their function, not knowing where it fit into the larger puzzle.
That's right. When they were said, okay, in the drill, you press this button. And exactly did that button do? Well, that's not a part of the compartmentalized information that you have. Okay? So, one might ask, well, why is it necessary for the truth movement to to think about these things? And I think the answer is that in order to have an understanding of what went on, we do have to think both inside and outside the box, so to speak, and really delve fairly deeply into these matters. And having said that, I think that provides a segue into our next two requests for correction, Jim. Both of them reflect a great deal of thinking outside the box. And as a result of doing so, the two people who are responsible for those requests for correction have really been pilloried. Now, and I say that because both Dr. Morgan Reynolds and Dr. Judy Wood have each come up with causal theories associated with 9/11 that at first glance may appear to be a bit mind-boggling. Morgan Reynolds has done a lot to advance the notion that what you thought you saw happen on 9/11 was actually very misleading and was more in the nature of a psychological operation, or so-called PSYOP. As most of your listeners probably know, Morgan Reynolds is very closely associated with the no big Boeing theory, that is to say that it was not large jetliners that crashed into the Twin Towers, but something else, either missiles or something else. And among the many incongruities that Morgan has been able to point to is the fact that the jetliners, as seen in all of the videos, crashed headlong into the World Trade Center buildings, entering it from tip to stern or from from nose to tail, wingtip to wingtip, without ever bending, slowing, or degrading in any way. It was all of the images confirmed that the planes entered the buildings as though they were a hot knife and as though the buildings were butter. But as a matter of fact, the buildings are made out of strong reinforced steel and the planes are aluminum. And aluminum can't go through steel in the way that those planes are seen to have done. Now, what Morgan Reynolds RFC focuses on is that the NIST contractors who worked with NIST prepared certain simulations and came up with certain data that actually, Jim, incorporated the what was seen on video, and they prepared expensive simulations and then made other calculations and determinations based on the simulations as though those planes could in fact go through that building as though it were butter and they were hot knives.
Well, Morgan has certainly done very patient calculations and given very interesting and formidable arguments about the anomalies in the photographic record, Jerry. I myself have seen multiple photographs that cause problems. One of from a helicopter of a cruise missile heading toward the building, another of a hypersonic plane flashing by the building, others where you see a plane heading toward the building that would impact with it, but others taken from a similar perspective at the same time showing no plane heading for the building. I think there's a serious question here as to which of the photographic record in this case is authentic and which is not, because they cannot all be correct.
Well, that's correct, but the simulations that that Morgan calls attention to in his RFC do in fact show a plane doing impossible, physically impossible things.
Yeah.
Now, Morgan's RFC also calls attention to one particular contractor, by name. And the name of that contractor that NIST use is Applied Research Associates, Applied Research Associates, Inc., also known as ARA.
Yeah.
Well, you know, ARA has an interesting line of business. Of all the things that that ARA could be principally involved with, the one thing that they could be involved with that would give me personally pause for concern is if you were to tell me that ARA is primarily a manufacturer of directed energy weapons.
Well, Jerry, that's very disconcerting.
If you were to tell me that ARA is a major manufacturer of directed energy weapons, I'd have a concern.
Yes.
Well, Jim, guess what?
They are.
They are.
It's amazing, you know, like they have this outfit called Controlled Demolition Incorporated cleaning up. And, they're one of the few companies in the world that could have brought those buildings down, in particular Building 7, for example. 1 and 2 seem to be more sophisticated kinds of destruction, but they were also involved in the cleanup of the Murrah building in Oklahoma City. I think it's very troubling, but, you know, it can't be more clever. It's like, just using the guy who was responsible for the whole thing and putting him out front. In the case of the, investigations of the CIA within relation to the Warren Commission or the House Select Committee, they put out their best guy to coordinate the relationship, and no doubt he was somebody who knew a whole lot about it.
Right. Okay, well, seems like we're going to take a little break, and then we'll be right back, right, Jim?
Exactly, Jerry. Thanks so much. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest today, 9/11 activist attorney Jerry Liepart. Stand by. We're continuing our conversation with Jerry Liepart, a 9/11 activist attorney who's representing three complainants in their requests for correction to the NIST, National Institute for Standards and Technology, in relation to their reports about the disaster of 9/11. Jerry, please continue.
Okay, Jim. In the last segment, we had discussed the fact that NIST contractor, ARA, is a major manufacturer of directed energy weapons. Now, we've come to a point where, you know, at the beginning of the raising of the theory that directed energy weapons appeared to be a causal factor in the destruction of the World Trade Center, something that Dr. Judy Wood pioneered as a theory, and indeed her request for correction centers on a demonstration of that claim and a demonstration of how and why NIST's NCSTAR 1 report fundamentally lacks in quality and integrity, because it fails to describe an abundance of phenomena that should have been described or at least explained or touched upon by NIST, but instead NIST avoided the discussion altogether of what caused the destruction of the World Trade Center Twin Towers by curtailing its analysis up to an arbitrary point that it referred to as the initiation of collapse, and then NIST politely explained that it wouldn't bother to discuss, analyze, much less explain anything that happened afterwards.
Yeah, there are several fascinating aspects about that, Jerry. One, of course, is its utter failure to discharge its own mandate, which was to explain how and why the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers in particular, collapsed. And, of course, they have nothing to say about the other buildings,
right.
Not even to this date about Building 7, except you're suggesting there's some tentative or preliminary report. But
that's such a massive
embarrassment that the 9/11 Commission, for example, didn't even bother to mention Building 7 in its report.
That's right.
And second of all, this selective use of evidence is quite characteristic of used car salesmen, editorial writers, and may I dare say defense attorneys, because they're presenting only the evidence favorable to their case. That violates a basic condition of scientific reasoning known as the requirement of total evidence, which insists that in attempting to determine the truth, you must base your reasoning on all of the available relevant evidence, where evidence is relevant when its truth or falsity or its presence or absence makes a difference to the truth or falsity of the conclusion.
Well, certainly those who are subject to the Data Quality Act must do that. They are mandated to do that, okay? Advocates, lawyers, for example, representing one side or another, have to adhere to the quality standard of representing their client to the best of their ability. That's a deeper philosophical discussion, Jim, that that you and I can have on another broadcast. How about that?
My pleasure.
Okay, but getting back to the RFC filed by Judy Wood, that advances the theory that directed energy weapons were a causal factor in the destruction of the Twin Towers, and for that matter, the rest of the World Trade Center complex, other than Building 7. The evidence that she presents is presented not for the purpose of taking on the burden of proof that, you know, that she has to prove it, but rather for the purpose of demonstrating that the NIST report, NCSTAR 1, is utterly inadequate as an explanatory document and must be retracted in its entirety. Just by way of example, even use of the word collapse to describe the top-down, you know, less than 10-second total destruction of each of the Twin Towers is in and of itself the misuse of a word. The process seen and the results derived from it are not a collapse. It's a destruction. It's a piecemeal destruction that left almost no debris. It was mostly turned to dust. So that is an energy phenomenon, or a phenomenon based upon energy that goes stupendously farther than either gravity or impact damage or kerosene, which is what jet fuel is, could possibly have caused. And that's a common sense observation. And so there, keep in mind what we said about the secrecy apparatus earlier on. Almost anyone with technical expertise in any engineering, scientific, or even manufacturing process will likely know, just all you have to do is look, maybe not even all that closely, to see that the destruction of the Twin Towers involved, at the very least, something that was highly unusual in terms of its energetic properties.
That's absolutely right, Jerry, and I think that Judy's submission is an absolute masterpiece, is a very objective, balanced submission of the evidence that has to be taken into account. It's a wonderful supplement to all the work that can be found on her website at drjudywood.com.
Now, speaking of supplement, Judy Wood also did, in fact, supplement her RFC to call particular attention to the activity that ARA, the company Applied Research Associates, is normally engaged in. So that is now a matter of public record.
That's quite fascinating, Jerry, and startling. I mean, when you have the possibility that directed energy weapons were used here, which for which there appears to be a rather broad range of circumstantial evidence, including, of course, the toasted car phenomenon, that a company with those kinds of connections should be involved as a consultant is a very clear conflict of interest.
Well, on that note, Jim, when you actually take a look at the list of contractors and of consultants that NIST used to prepare its report, if you just have in mind the issue of conflict of interest and what it really means, that is to say, you don't conduct an investigation based upon the input of parties who have a direct or indirect interest in the outcome. Certainly the entire premise of quality also includes, and in the Data Quality Act very specifically mentioned, the concept of integrity. And what quality and integrity simply mean in this context is that even if the parties are totally innocent, you don't set it up so that questions like this can be raised.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Jerry Leapheart. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. We're discussing requests for correction submitted to the National Institute for Standards and Technology and related to in relation to their reports about 9/11 with activist attorney Jerry Leapheart. Jerry, you know, the idea there of involving these people in investigating these cases seems to me to have several parallels with this administration. They have engaged in the process of using lobbyists to write legislation that would cover the organizations or corporations for which they represent. They have, of course, been stacking the federal prosecutors with biased attorneys who are going to abuse their role to promote the Republican agenda or the Bush agenda. So I suppose the idea of having criminals investigated their own crimes, it makes perfectly good sense from the point of view of the Bush administration.
Well, in some of those instances, you're virtually powerless to do anything about it because it though questionable, though odious, perhaps it doesn't run afoul of a particular law or regulation. In this instance, however, the Data Quality Act, in all of its two paragraphs, does nonetheless impose, this requirement that, that data, must adhere to quality standards. And when that data, is compiled on the basis of either information that is false, misleading, and/or when it lacks integrity because it's being assembled or worked on by parties that have a conflict of interest by virtue of who they are and what involvement they may have had in the underlying events or topics, then that work can be challenged, first under the Data Quality Act and then later under other procedures. Now, let's just leave that there. Now, the next thing I want to do, Jim, is just, you know, and have a little experiment, conduct a little experiment with you in thinking about the events of 9/11 and in thinking about the issue of conflict of interest. You know, you might just think out loud and brainstorm about, if you are going to have a concern about an investigation that should not have the appearance of a conflict of interest present, what companies or entities would you really not want to see involved in the investigation that that NIST conducted?
I would think none in the military-industrial complex, especially none related to high-tech weapons, directed energy weapons, lasers, masers, plasmoids. You'd need very objective, independent, detached scholars and experts and scientists to deal with these issues.
Well, let's that's a good starting point. Now let's come in from the general down to a little more specifics. Of the entities that, you know, that can actually be said to have been involved in 9/11 in some way or another, either in terms of what happened to them, or what their interests were, name one, two, or three companies or entities that you would think should not be involved in the investigation.
Well, Silverstein Properties, I would think, would be an obvious choice.
So the question is that you're raising is Silverstein Properties listed as a consultant to NIST for purposes of the NC Star 1 investigation? Is that what you're asking, Jim?
Are you telling me it is? I'd be shocked.
Got the long answer or the short answer?
Go ahead.
Well, I give you the long answer. Yes.
Unbelievable.
Name another.
I mean, because there's an obvious case here for insurance fraud, an obvious case. Well, I'd wonder about Solomon Brothers, which had, you know, a huge complex on the in Building 7, but I would suppose, you know, they're just going to be an impartial party waiting to hear what actually happened.
Yes, Solomon is not mentioned. However, Boeing is, American Airlines is, United Airlines is. Now, you know, I myself was interested in doing a thought experiment and to just, you know, think about, well, if 9/11 can really be seen as being a PSYOP, you know, short for psychological operation,
yeah.
Is it possible, and as I'm asking myself this question, I'm saying, nah, they wouldn't do that, but is it possible that one of NIST's contractors might have expertise in PSYOPs? Nah, they wouldn't do that.
So who we got here, Jerry?
Okay, you all like suspense, huh?
Well, I just think your discoveries are completely fascinating.
What about if you had the same company that was given the contract to go in and turn Iraqi media, press and radio and TV, into a propaganda outlet, receive millions of dollars for doing it, but then losing the contract since obviously their effort to turn Iraqi media into U.S. invasion-friendly propaganda didn't work. You wouldn't expect a company like that to be involved in the NIST investigation, would you?
Not if it were honest and upright, Jerry. No, I wouldn't.
Well, okay. They are.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
So, Jim, this is a, you know, we're discussing this, I suppose, on, you know, a bit of a, you know, humorous note, you know, playing a game of, you know, question and answer, perhaps. But your listeners should know that we are saying these things with a certain earnestness and seriousness that, at bottom here, something is very seriously amiss, and it must be challenged through all appropriate legal means.
Oh, absolutely, Jerry. I mean, it's just that the, you know, the hypocrisy, the deceit, and the deception is so blatant. I mean, it's just astonishing. This is as in your face as having the outfit that cleans up all the debris of what appears to be, you know, one or another kind of controlled demolition, be Controlled Demolition Incorporated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Jerry Liepart. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Jerry, before we continue, I'd just like to refer back to the point I was making about scientific reasoning. I didn't mean to imply that defense attorneys weren't fulfilling their proper role in giving only evidence favorable to their client. That's part of our adversarial system. It also reflects the fact that their role is very different than an objective truth-finding investigation, so that, you know, judicial procedures and scientific inquiries actually are governed by very different rules and regulations.
Well, okay, but keep in mind that prosecuting attorneys
there are higher obligations to evaluate both sides of the case. Absolutely right.
No, that's not what I was going to say. I was going to say that they're just as adversarial as are anyone else.
But in principle, the prosecution is supposed to bear the burden of considering all sides and be, you know, pursuing justice, which is supposed to be fair to the victim and to the accused.
Well, my experience with them is that they're out there trying to win. But be all of that as it may be, I think our task here is to actually determine whether and to what extent information that that we have, you know, might need to be made available.
Yeah.
To prosecuting attorneys. Now, you know, having said that, it's also pretty clear that we ourselves must deal with this. You know, it is our duty as citizens, you know, of the U.S. And for that matter, having you know, a responsibility to the world at large. I can tell you that something that's almost came up a little bit earlier, and that is that it was one thing for Dr. Wood to call attention to directed energy weapons, for doing so, I think she has actually pulled off something that is of historical significance. We're only at the beginning of determining the full and the complete ramifications of what Judy Wood has called attention to. But you know, this is a new class of super weapons, Jim, and the information about directed energy weapons is you know, is not that easy to come by. You know, most of it you know, remains highly classified. But from the starting point of you know, my awareness of Dr. Wood's theory, which I think her website on this went up in the latter part of October of last year. So, you know, let's say you know, a bit over what, 5 or 6 months?
Yeah.
That this information has been out there, and that, you know, I you know, as a citizen, you know, found it so compelling that you know, I just needed to, for my own purposes, you know, come to grips with this information, because the visual confirmation was just so obvious to me that, you know, I needed to apprise myself of it. Now, not many people know this about me, but In an earlier stage of my career, I actually had an involvement in that branch of law, Jim, that we call space law.
Uh-huh.
And I was an investigator in the area of space law or outer space law. As early as, I don't want to date myself overly much, but, you know, going back to the late 1970s. And even then, you know, back and certainly by the early 80s with the actual onset of the call for the Strategic Defense Initiative or the Star Wars program, you know, a key element of that program right from the outset was laser weaponry, directed energy weapons, laser particle beam weapons. That was the gold standard, and I have been aware of the highly funded effort to develop those weapons going back for more than 30 years. Okay, that's that effort has always been intensive. It has always been a high priority.
Well, as a part of the full spectrum dominance scenario where the United States is supposed to dominate not only air, land, and sea, but also space, where space-based weapons provide the opportunity to dominate the entire globe.
I'm going to quote to you a piece of information that recently came to my attention. I want to let you know, Jim, you and the listeners know that there's actually a lot more information available to the public in the public domain about the existence of laser weapons than we may have originally or first thought. Now, let me just toss this out there for those who might like to inform themselves a bit more about the subject of high-energy laser weapons. There are two centers that are deeply involved in this form of weaponry. One is the Kirtland Air Force Base, located in or near Albuquerque, New Mexico. The other is Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. At Wright-Patt, there is the Air Force Institute of Technology, and there you have a center for directed energy. Okay? There is also a society called the Directed Energy Professional Society. Your listeners would do well to take a look at the information available on that site. Now, here's a quote. The 10-mile laser, and this is an article by an individual named Don Slater, lasers and electro-optical systems of the Boeing Company.
Yes.
Quote, lasers in space. Lasers in the stratosphere, lasers on and over the battlefield. We're at the beginning of an evolutionary new wave of weaponry. Highly precise, long range, and primarily defensive in application, high energy lasers are emerging as key components in the military planner's options for defense against intercontinental ballistic missiles, theater ballistic missiles, overland and anti-ship cruise missiles, and short range rockets. One of the newest concepts is the airborne tactical laser, which is seeking to join space-based laser and the high-altitude airborne laser in moving from laboratory technology validation to government-sponsored concept demonstration and ultimately to operational capability. Now, what have I just said? I've just said there are already lasers in space and lasers at the high altitude of the high altitude airborne variety.
They're out there and they're operational. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. We'll be right back with my guest, Jerry Liepart. You know, Jerry, since I had my first interview with Judy about all this stuff and the very idea that to directed energy or some kind of high-tech weapon might have been involved, I've been simply astonished by the amount of dissent, criticism, satire, just ridicule that has been aimed at her and even at me for merely discussing the idea. It's shocking, it's unscientific, it's authoritarian, it commits all kinds of fallacies, you know, ad hominem, begging the question, popular sentiments and the like. I've just been shocked especially by some who pose as scientists who have displayed such a completely unscientific attitude. So it's been a very disillusioning experience in many ways.
Well, I think that I want to commend Dr. Judy Wood for just going forward with her research and having the courage to engage in the analytic process and be willing to go where the analysis takes her. This is evidence-based. You know, what I just read to you and to the listeners about high altitude and space base lasers already being in effect was written in the year 2000, Jim.
Oh, you know, Jerry, Judy, one of her examples is the testing of a laser that was directed from Earth onto a mirror in space and came back on its target that was conducted in 1991.
Yes, this is as I've said. You know, I've known for decades of the intensity of the effort to develop this kind of weaponry, and the strides that have been made from approximately 1990 onward have been pretty astonishing. Now, the secrecy surrounding the actual capabilities of the weaponry remains pretty intense. Now, of course, you know, one way actually to put a certain kind of test to Dr. Wood's theory would be simply to have an understanding of what effects can the current generation, or more specifically, the generation of laser weapons available in the year 2001, you know, what effects can they or are they expected to bring about?
Yeah, that's great because, you know, others have explored this possibility. Webster Tarpley in 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA not only talks about the possibility that directed energy weapons might have been used on the Twin Towers, but he has a key sentence in relation to the almost complete absence of aircraft debris in Shanksville, and suggests that it could possibly have been shot down by a Lockheed Hercules C-130 transport plane, for example, about 17 miles away. Such a plane could easily have carried a powerful airborne chemical laser, and this type of directed energy weapon based on new physical principles might have accounted for the physical effects actually observed on the scene. I mean, that's Webster Tarpley in a very prominent book. And yet he's not been assailed for his advancing that hypothesis, Jerry, so it makes you wonder why Judy should be such a target.
Well, I think that's because she has shown the visual effects that to this day are mind-boggling. That, you know, it takes it from theory to evidence in support. Now, we also know that, I mean, you know, in one of the principal components of space law is the fact that under the Comprehensive Outer Space Treaty, to which the U.S. is a full party, weapons are not allowed to be put into Earth orbit or into space. However, the temptation to do so is obviously, pretty overwhelming. We, after all, are a country that accounts for half of the defense expenditures of the entire world combined, so meaning that we outspend the rest of the world combined. So the temptation to put such weapons in space is quite strong. And in addition, as recently as October of last year, 2006, we know that a directive was issued by the executive branch that had the effect of indicating that it would be the intention of the United States to at least consider placing weapons in space. Now, we say all of that just to, you know, call attention to the reality of the evidence that we have before us, the context in which that evidence exists, and other corollary factors that can and should be taken into consideration in considering what happened. You know, our next step, I think, will be to try to bring all of this information together and to use it for purposes of seeing if we ourselves, using the tools and the resources and the procedures, especially the legal procedures that are available to us, to try to come to grips with this stunningly important crisis that that we are in. Could more of us but realize it?
And I'm so fearful, Jerry, that not only now is 9/11 going to be used to justify, you know, subverting the Constitution through the Patriot Act, placing the whole nation under surveillance, curtailing our liberties and launching these wars of aggression, but that there may be an additional false flag attack, given the success of 9/11, in justifying in the eyes of the public all of these atrocious actions, which may lead to an attack on Iran. I dearly hope this does not come to pass, because it will be an even greater calamity than our intervention in Iraq. But it's entirely possible, because when the administration needs a terrorist act to affect the public attitude, it can make one up. It can make one to order, just like an omelet.
Yeah, yeah, psyops, unlimited. Well, we're in dire straits. I can take some comfort from having the opportunity to Jim to work with you, with Judy Wood, with Morgan Reynolds, with Ed Haas, and with the broader 9/11 truth community as a whole. You know, yes, we have differences, and I'm not trying to paper over them or to pretend that that they do not exist. However, I would urge all of us in this movement, and however we perceive the issues, to be non-critical one of the other. There's, you know, it just serves no useful purpose. And I'm saying that to you, Jim, as well as to all of us. I'm saying that to myself as well. You know, we've got differences, and there's certainly nothing the matter with multiple approaches here. The group that I have the honor of representing is going forward with one prong, but we certainly would encourage others who might have either, you know, a different idea or a different way of proceeding to nonetheless you know, go for it with as much vigor as they can, as they and we can muster.
Well, I share all those sentiments, Jerry. Anyone who wants to understand what differences Jerry is alluding to should go to 911scholars.org and scroll down the right-hand side to a green box entitled The Science of 9/11, and they'll see video clips from several presentations I have made explaining why the evidence suggests that some kind of high-tech directed energy weapons were involved here, and why the evidence goes far beyond what conventional explosives or devices could explain. You also see a debate from the Chandler conference where Steve Jones, who represents the conventional explosive approach, and I exchange our views here. It's quite informative to understand the background to the issues. And while you're there, then flip over to the featured articles and read our press release about scholars filing changes to NIST reports on 9/11, where these submissions may shatter the cover-up. Jerry, I just can't thank you enough for your superb work here. Judy and Ed Haas and Morgan Reynolds all deserve our thanks and appreciation. And I expect we're going to be hearing more about this, Jerry, and I'll look forward to having you back on the program to discuss it further.
Oh, it would be my pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so very much. We've been listening to Jerry Liepart, 9/11 activist attorney, on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host. Thank you for listening.